Hello and welcome to episode 15 of the Vera Shafiq podcast. Real and relevant discussions on business, marketing, technology, and digital. I'm your host, Vera Shafiq, and I talk to people in business and marketing who care about doing marketing the right way and want to be proud of the work they do. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe and review, and I hope you enjoy the show. So on today's episode, I speak to Brad Moran, who's the co-founder and CEO of CitrusAd, a retail media platform, and we talk in detail about how he started the business, how marketers can leverage retail media to drive performance, and what the future looks like for retail media. Enjoy the show. Okay, today on the podcast, we welcome Brad Moran. Brad started his career playing professional Australian Football League before founding his first e-commerce tech company at the age of 24. 6 years on and obtaining an incredible amount of startup experience, Brad left his first company and founded CitrusAd, a world-leading white-label self-serve e-commerce advertising platform that enables retailers to monetize their digital shelf space while enabling suppliers to increase sales by launching targeted and cost-effective digital campaigns right at the point of purchase. Brad joins us today from his hometown of Brisbane, Australia. Welcome, Brad, to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Vera. I think you can just about do a mic drop there and let it be. Best introduction I think I've ever had.
So, awesome. Well, I took most of that off your website, so disclaimer there. But so you did a great job there on the website telling your story. But talking about stories, can you introduce yourself to the listeners and give them a little bit about your backstory and how you got where you are right now at CitrusAd?
Yeah, total fluke, to be honest. Like most founder stories, I grew up in England. So I moved to Australia when I was 15, started playing Australian rules football at 17, but drafted to the Pro League at 18, spent 8 years playing it professionally. A couple of injuries sort of led me down the path of wanting to exit and consider my future after football. And, the natural transition from football was obviously into tech startups. So I basically decided that I'd use the last year of my contract as a springboard to start a tech company. And from there, it was really just me and Google. And what I mean by that is it was really me asking Google several questions, such as how to start a company, how do you raise money, how do you build a business plan, plagiarizing everything I possibly could in order to just try and get something off the ground. But one of the good things about having the football club around me was that I got to speak to some very high caliber businessmen, particularly sponsors of the club. So I got to meet some very successful businessmen and ask their advice, got to meet some stockbrokers, got to meet some very clever bankers, very clever, startup people. So very, very fortunate that I got to use my kind of professional career in sport to transition into tech. So the first company I built was basically the, very similar to Uber Eats, but we built it in 2010. So we had a native ordering app for food and coffee for the iPhone 3GS. So, it was very, very ahead of its time. Unfortunately, too far ahead of its time. The timing and everything with startups, as we've certainly learned over the last 5 years. So we pivoted a few times. We learned all the mistakes that we could possibly learn. We raised $1 million up front, which was a pretty good feat considering it was the middle of the GFC. I was a footballer who really knew nothing about tech or coding. And then we basically got going. We launched the app. It was very successful early days. We didn't make any money. Couldn't quite figure out how to make money, as most startups always have that challenge. Mm-hmm. And then we pivoted into providing a sort of white label version of, the kind of Uber. So brands could take our tech, rebrand it themselves, sell it to their own customers, started to build a bit of revenue that way, won a global tender with Westfield Labs based out of San Francisco, and then just fortuitously ended up in grocery. So we decided to build out a grocery platform for a particular client and then thought, we're onto something here. No one else is in the market. We then very quickly realized why no one else is in the market, because it was extremely difficult to build an e-com platform for grocery, mainly because of the data that's pulling out of the point of sale. So back in 2014, when we first started, you know, there wasn't product data wasn't readily available. So we had to try and translate point of sale names into readable names that a search engine could absorb. So we went through all the hard yards in trying to develop an e-com platform. And that really helped us understand a lot about grocery, understand a lot about the picking and packing. So we built a picking and packing app, like a fulfillment system. And so whilst we had a very sophisticated mobile app ordering platform and a website ordering platform, 90% of our time was spent on the fulfillment side. So we became almost a fulfillment company. We built everything from, you know, picking apps to shopping carts. You know, we were almost in the hardware business towards the end. Mm-hmm. And I still remember going to the NGA, you know, trade show, and it was so funny. You know, we looked a bit like an Apple store and a flea market. So obviously everything that we did was brilliant white, and we built a tall stand. And the first year that we went, you know, no one was really interested in tech, or we were just a bit too far advanced. Like grocery, mid-tier grocery retailers like things they can touch and feel. And you can't touch and feel software. So, you know, they didn't really know what to do with it. And so the next year we went back and we put all the emphasis around this shopping cart. You know, we built this like state-of-the-art shopping cart that had an iPad attached to it, had a scanning gun attached to it. And it was as if we bought like a Playboy model to the stand. Like everyone was so focused on this shopping cart. It was really just like 1% of the whole end-to-end experience. But we knew where the pain points were, right? But like this is the pain point for retailers. It's the fulfillment. So we focused all of our attention there. And then, you know, once we started to get some market traction, things didn't end well for me and my co-founder. We both got fired from that business for all sorts of reasons, which I won't divulge today. But very typical of a startup, you know, if the likes of Steve Jobs can get fired from his own company, I'm sure it's fair to say that small-time founders like Nick and I can get fired from our business. Right. So 2016, we ended up back in Australia, tail between our legs after living in the US for a year, building the business out there. But we'd learned so much, you know, we thought it'd be a waste to see it all go to ground. We were pretty exhausted by that stage, you know, 6 years in a startup, pivoting several times, doing hundreds of thousands of miles a year in the air. I did about 6 day trips to the US from Brisbane, which is tough. So I remember traveling to Boston to meet with a retailer, and I literally got on a flight, flew to Boston, landed at 2 a.m. after three flights, had an 8 a.m. meeting, and then flew back to Australia on the 11 o'clock.
Wow, it's pretty brutal.
It was, yeah, but it's just what you had to do,
yeah,
you know, to try and build a business. So one thing that we did take away from that business was the significant lack of monetization for retailers, and grocery in particular. The grocery had the biggest pain points because of the heavy cost of fulfillment. So grocers were very reluctant to get online because of the costs. That, and they didn't really have great strategies. The industry was still becoming an industry. People really didn't know much about e-com. You know, that's why there were several disruptors that took the market on, like Instacart, Amazon Prime, Amazon Fresh. Like, and so, so we tried to help educate the retailers. At the same time, you know, brands would approach us and ask us, you know, if they could get to top position. And then we came up with the concept of Citrus, which is really about buying shelf space, but in the digital format. So as e-com was growing and we could see it growing, we knew that grocers needed a supplementary income, which they generate largely in store now. If you look at a grocer's P&L, I think you'd find running at a, you know, 1-2% profit margin, you know, on a good day. The minute that you turn that into an online order, they're running at a deficit of, say, 40%. You know, so
right.
they needed surplus surplus revenue. And if you think about a grocer's P&L, most of their profit comes from advertising, whether that's selling space in digital circulars, regular circulars, email, in-store shelf space, which is all bundled together as part of co-op marketing, but most of their revenue comes from marketing. And so obviously it was a natural fit. We saw the fit. We saw where the market was going. And then we decided to build a platform that was going to address the needs of the retailer, which is, how do I monetize my online shelf space? And how do I let my brands do it in a self-serve fashion? And how do I make sure that I don't affect my user experience? And so those are the kind of core principles in which we built our platform off. So we very much modeled our business on Stripe.com. You know, mm-hmm. Stripe built an API, very successful in growing their business because of the API-based nature, which meant that anyone could integrate to them. They didn't have to have, you know, operational people all over the globe. It also put the retailers in full control as well. So it's a request-only system. So they send us what they want, and then they request from us what they want. So it kind of puts the retailer in control. So we knew after being in grocery for so long that control is everything. You know,
yeah.
People don't let go of control of their sites. And then obviously we took into consideration the relevancy side. So we looked at, okay, how do we make sure we serve the relevant ads to the most relevant people? So we obviously added in a layer of personalization.
Mm-hmm.
So the retailer would send us, okay, here's a request for an ad with some context about who's on the site, who's looking at the page, what page it is. So it's milk and it's customer XYZ. And then we look at all the contesting ads and we pick the best ones to show to that particular customer. So it's a win-win-win. It's a win for the retailer, it's a win for the customer, it's a win for the brand. And
yep.
That was always our ethos.
Yep.
And then that's how we started out. And then from there, you know, I can skip over kind of 4 years of growth.
Yeah.
But effectively, we tackled, unlike many of the sort of competitors in the space, that most of them came from media backgrounds. You know, if you look at a lot of the competitors in the space, they all came from like ex-WPP, ex-Publicis. You know, they'd seen the writing on the wall too, but they saw it from a different lens. So they saw it from a publisher advertiser perspective and built some software that enabled it to be, you know, join the dots. Whereas we looked at it very much from a technical perspective. So we wanted to build a very strong tech stack. In fact, we didn't actually know a lot about media when we first started Citrus. Now, if I'm brutally honest, which yeah. I always am, you know, you asked me what a DSP was 3 years ago. I couldn't tell you. I didn't know what DSP, SSP meant. I didn't know what programmatic meant. But I knew retail and I knew what they needed. And I think that's what's, you know, held us in good stead. And obviously over time we've learned, you know, the industry. We've learned the greater industry. And we've hired people that know the greater industry. So I think from us, you know, we launched in 2016, the idea. We were live by the end of 2017 with one retailer, and now we're sort of 65 retailers strong across 25 countries and, you know, working with some of the world's largest grocers, e-com sites, electronics retailers, homeware retailers. So I think that the technology has kind of ticked the box in terms of what we wanted it to do, which was scale quickly across a broad spectrum of different retail clients. So
yeah, I think that's an amazing story. And I think it's a testament to what entrepreneurs typically go through or the journey that they go through because, you know, it's never an overnight success. There's always going to be trials and tribulations. And it sounds like you went through several pivots, a failure here and there, and eventually got to where you are from just learning from your mistakes. And I think that's just awesome because that's the way anyone ends up being successful, I believe. And I think it was really interesting that you mentioned that, you know, you did everything from a technology perspective because at the end of the day, you were seeing pain points that retailers were having. You were seeing potentially pain points that customers were having, and you were tackling those pain points from that angle rather than, as you mentioned, the media angle. And I think that's what makes you guys different and really kind of allows you to scale, as you mentioned, because from what I understand, a retailer can get up and running really quickly with your platform. Is that correct?
Yeah, typically once the, you know, the contract length is always the timely part for most retailers. But once they get going, anywhere between, you know, 3 to 6 weeks, they can be up and running with sponsored products. We do offer banners as well, brand pages, emails. So obviously everything's incremental in terms of time.
Right.
And then the further they want to delve into the platform, obviously that takes a little longer. But if you wanted to integrate everything from start to finish and include a suite of products, you're probably looking at a maximum of 8 weeks. So quick to start bringing in significant revenue. So
yeah, that's
we have one customer in the UK, you know, large tier one retailer go from 0 to £2.5 million a month in 2 months.
Wow. That's amazing.
Obviously a lot of pre-work we help them with, you know, get going once they launch, but certainly, yeah, very fast process.
Yeah, that's very cool. So, you know, the kind of big question would be, you know, we just went through a global pandemic. How did that affect your business? I would imagine it kind of catapulted you into an even more successful realm. But tell me about how COVID has affected Citrus Ad.
Good question. So COVID initially nearly killed our company.
Oh, really? Okay. Interesting.
A couple of reasons. We were just raising capital in the middle of COVID.
Right.
So we had a term sheet about to get executed. And, you know, we were going for our Series A round. It wouldn't have killed the business, but it certainly wouldn't have set it back a long way. But the investment bank, Moelis, decided to go through with their promise. So that was, you know, a bullet dodged. And then, you know, we saw a few different sides of COVID. So the retailers that were currently live on our platform saw an increase, but then they saw too much of an increase where they had to turn off their platforms. So we didn't see COVID as an immediate revenue spike. We saw it actually as a major problem. So, you know, we had a lot of retailers who had to curb their amount of orders that they could fulfill. Obviously, as you know, in media, advertisers and brands can't just turn on the spin of a dime. You know, they can't just go, hey, I'm going to reallocate my money to e-com now. So we went through probably 3 months of just burying down the hatchets and trying to make sure our retailers are supported.
Right.
You know, nothing happened on the sales side. You know, every retailer that we knew of, you know, the biggest retailers, Woolworths, Coles here in Australia, these are $50 billion companies, had everyone in their digital team in the fulfillment centers picking and packing orders. So they had no time to think about retail media. You know, sure. It was basically, you know, we need to fulfill the orders. We need to get orders out to customers. And so for a period of March to say August, the business was just in a holding pattern, you know, and then as we started to come out of the back of at least that first frantic part of COVID, we definitely saw an uplift in inquiries. So everyone then started to go, hey, we didn't have a retail media program. This has cost us a lot of money and we probably need one. You know, we need to make some revenue off our site since one, it's getting a lot more traffic now, and two, it's costing us a fortune to run. So, you know, I think we received about 20 RFPs in Q3 last year, most of which we won, which we were quite happy with. But Q4 again was similar. So we started to launch more clients in Q4. So they were the more aggressive clients, the ones that needed to get out to market quickly. But it's really been, you know, a half to exponential growth for us. So, you know, revenue wise, I think we did about 4 million from January to June. And then we did 20 million from July to December, you know, so right. It's significant shift in profile in terms of company size. So everything shifted kind of post July. But obviously now that we're in the kind of, we're riding the wave of COVID, it's nice. You know, now everyone is, you know, a year ago we had to go out to the market and educate people why they needed retail media or what it was, you know, e-commerce advertising. Now we're in a luxury position of everyone knows what it is now or knows sort of what it is, you know, and they know what, you know, the general basics of it. You know, people are starting to write about it. You know, people like you are starting to talk about it. Mm-hmm. Everyone's producing papers. Amazon's continuing to kill it, which is great for us. You know, everyone's looking towards what Amazon does it. I must do it too. Walmart's obviously making a huge splash. Target are very successful. So, you know, I think that's really helped our business in terms of the inbound inquiries. So, obviously, with any product, you have to have supply and demand. And, you know, 2 years ago, the demand wasn't there. It doesn't matter if you had the supply, you know. Whereas now, I think there are, you know, in the last sort of 6 months, I think we've had about 50 inbound inquiries. So as a company like us, it's great to see that the industry is now starting to understand it, starting to want to get involved. And, of course, that's better for everyone in the cycle, including the brands.
Yeah, I think what the pandemic's done, as you mentioned, is really educated and created awareness around, okay, well, you know, people are shopping online more. Obviously, COVID forced people to change their shopping behaviors. Direct-to-consumer is now, you know, the big thing. The buzz is around direct response advertising. So, we are hearing a lot about retail media now. You know, there was news recently that Walmart have their own Walmart Connect, I think it's called, which they've released, where, you know, they're now getting on that train. And we're hearing all these other retailers, as you mentioned, in the US, Target, Walmart, Best Buy, you know, the list goes on. They're all kind of getting into retail media. So that's what piqued my attention. I've been hearing about it a lot, and I really think it is something that's going to take off. So in terms of, from a marketing perspective, because this is really what this podcast is geared towards, it's marketers, people that are looking to improve their skills in that profession. From that perspective, how does, you know, what kind of marketers would you say a Citrus Ad is suited towards? Like, who should be looking at Citrus Ad from a marketing perspective?
I think naturally, anyone with a client or clientele base that's in retail, naturally.
Yeah.
Whether you're a tier one agency, boutique agencies, you know, I think people have made a business out of becoming performance agencies now. So agencies have started to break off into sort of different skill sets, and they're the ones that have certainly relished in this growth. So take iProspect in the UK. You know, excellent company at search. They've mastered it. They've become very, very knowledgeable in Amazon, which is then transferred into other retailers. So I think that, you know, I think that if I was a marketer, I would be definitely all over the suppliers to the industry. So people like CitrusAd, Criteo, Microsoft, and just be wanting to understand how the industry works. You know, I'm happy to give my time to anyone that asks for it. So, because I think there's still a lot of things that people just don't know. And there's a million different strategies out there. It's not just a one shoe fits all.
Yeah.
If you're a big brand, you have a different strategy to a small brand. Challenger brands, if you're advertising on a big retailer, a small retailer, whether you're acting on behalf of the brand or the retailer, you know, they're all very, very different. But at the end of the day, you simply cannot spend too much on retail media. Because at the end of the day, the retailers are at the point of purchase. So they're ultimately where marketers have been spending the money in the last 10 years, that $160 billion industry that Google and Facebook have created. Yeah, so marketers have been trying to use that $160 billion over the past 10 years since Google and Facebook have really been around, trying to influence people when they're browsing or socializing about buying a product. And so it's a bit of a stab in the dark. It's a bit of a long play. Whereas advertising at the retailer, they're there to buy. They're there with the intent to purchase. And so from a marketer's perspective, I would start with the bottom up. You know, because retail media is not that big, you know, the traffic that even all the retailers combined get, bar Amazon, obviously, is very, very tiny compared to the reach that Google and Facebook have. So I would be focusing my attention on, okay, well, where can I get the biggest bang for buck? where can I get the most amount of direct reporting on sales versus money spent? So if I look at money in, money out, retailers are going to give me that best bang for buck, which is why you're seeing the explosion in the industry. At the end of the day, it's been happening for decades. You know, retailers have been selling shelf space to brands for decades and, you know, ad space to brands for decades. This is just a new, cleverer format for them. So I would be getting in, you know, me personally, if I was a marketer, understanding what it is, all the metrics associated with it, trying to get through the noise. So what's noise versus what's truth? You know, everyone has their own spin on what an effective strategy is, what good results look like. There's then the argument between what's good for the retailer, then what's good for the brand.
So,
you know, you've got to look at it from a, depending on who you're representing, you've got to look at it from, you know, the perspective of understand the landscape in general, but then look at it from a, okay, am I representing a small brand, big brand, or am I representing the retailer here? So, you know, understand all the metrics that are involved, understand how it works, understand how to bid, you know, how, is it a first price auction? Is it a second price auction? You know, is it a display ad that I'm working on? Is it a responsive product I'm working on? All very, very different. So I think that if I was a marketer, I'd be going and asking as many possible questions as I could, because there's a huge opportunity out there for agencies, independent boutique agencies, consultants, contractors. We're scratching the surface of an industry that's going to be, you know, a multi 10, 20, maybe even $100 billion industry come 5 years from now. And so a lot of that is going to still be under management. Not going to be brand direct. The big brands like P&G, Unilever, they want to take it direct because they've got the budgets and the teams and the appetite. But for most brands, it will still be under management. So, you know, there's a lot of opportunity for marketers, I think. But it's, you know, you've got to be specialists in this area. You've got to understand how it works.
It sounds to me like as a marketer or advertiser, I would look at this as a low-hanging fruit, definitely, because like you mentioned, it's the point of purchase. People are, you've got their captive attention. They're in the market. They're ready to buy. They're ready to pull the trigger. So it's a matter of figuring out, okay, am I doing some search ads here? Am I capturing search intent? Or should I put a display banner up or, you know, do a brand page? And I think you also have email advertising as well. So that's kind of an interesting concept as well. So I think it's a matter of actually figuring out your marketing mix on the retail media platform itself. And going after that as a low-hanging fruit definitely sounds like an opportunity right there. So talking about that, you mentioned the data. What kind, and you said that it's very data-driven, results are very clear from performance. And what kind of data can a marketer get off a platform like Citrus Ad? How accurate is it and what's the attribution like?
Yeah, so a few questions in there. I'll talk about attribution separately because it's a hot topic at the moment. But look, Citrus provides a dashboard for both brand and retailer. So that's one of the things that we did focus on when we first built the platform is the UI. So we take pride in making sure that the user interface is really easy to use, easy to navigate, provides the brands with all of the metrics they need to view. So very similar to a Google or an Amazon. So they're viewing product level data, search term level data, campaign level data, share of voice, you know, how much they're paying CPC, what the average CPC is. So all of the metrics that they need to know to run a successful campaign, including, hey, here's the recommended CPC or the winning CPC for this particular search term. Then we go a little bit deeper in terms of what we can provide to the suppliers. So for me, value is always built in, you know, I'm very strong on in pushing value. You know, where is the value in the ads? The value in the ads is looking at overall sales. You know, looking at, you know, did this increase my sales? What did the customer, was the customer already going to buy it anyway? You know, what's my market share movement like? You know, am I winning my market share over my competitors? Because if you looked at, you know, if people just look at CPC, so how much am I paying for this click? And they look at the return on ad spend, it's a very lazy way of going, okay, I've ticked all the boxes. You know, I spent a dollar, I got $3 back. I'm good. Where things get interesting is we see some of the more aggressive brands understanding the space a lot more. So, you know, I'm going to call them out. Mondelez is a very, very smart, aggressive brand. So what they have figured out very quickly is that they want to win at all costs, because they know that by bidding and winning, that the person continues to buy their product. And so they're not just paying for that one-off transaction, they're paying for a lifetime value of a customer, which, think about from a brand's perspective, how much is that worth? You know, $3 is a pretty good buy, you know? So when you look at some of the return on ad spend, you're like, geez, these guys are crazy. They're bidding $5 for a dollar product. You know, the return on ad spend is negative, but they're doing it for a very strategic reason, because their overall market share is moving and they're beating their competitors. So this is where we look at, you know, the metrics and then the metrics. You know, you've got, what is it that you're trying to do here? And ultimately what brands should be trying to do is increase the number of sales and increase their market share. So the stats that we give them in the dashboards, you know, can be viewed in many different ways and tick many different boxes, but ultimately they should be the two biggest things that CEOs and CMOs of these big companies should be worried about. Is as P&G, am I taking market share off Unilever? Okay, if I'm not, how do I do that? And that can be a combination between, you know, performance, so sponsored products, or, you know, launching a banner ad, so on and so forth. Yeah. So I think that's definitely around attribution, you know, the different types of attribution. Won't dig into too much around what's right and what's wrong. Different industries carry different attribution methods as well. So grocery, it tends to be a lot shorter. So, you know, people shop on a weekly cycle. So we tend not to go too far out with that attribution windows. So say 14 days is probably the most people tend to build a shop over that amount of time. Versus, say, homewares or fashion can be up to 30 days where people are browsing, clicking, wishlisting, then going back and transacting. So, you know, they're very, very different in that regard. So you do have to look at it from an industry by industry basis. But I think that's kind of our take on the sort of reporting side, the results and what brands should be focusing on.
Yeah. I would imagine that customer lifetime value might also be a metric that you're looking at, what's your take on that?
Yeah, it is a good one and a very good one to measure. It is sometimes somewhat hard to measure too, because it all depends on how much information you can get and how much information you can get in real time, and then being able to link the offline and online data as well. So naturally Citrus takes as much, we take all the online data from our retailer, so every single online transaction we have. So when we serve an ad, we take the customer ID, we look at who's on the page, we serve the most relevant ad to them based upon, you know, their past purchasing history. So we avoid that third-party cookie world, which is obviously about to explode, as we all know. The apocalypse is upon us. Even though the media are somewhat trying to downplay it, I think it's going to be a huge blow to anyone in that industry. Google, Facebook, you know, these guys have such big audiences themselves on a first-party databases that they can create walled gardens and ignore each other and still make a ton of money. So all they'll do is just cut out the middlemen who use the, you know, kind of cross-platform tracking to make their living. Whereas, you know, we live inside the walled garden, so we provide the walled garden to the retailer, and the retailer should really only care about their customers. And there's obviously off-site audience extension platforms that they can use to drive more traffic to them. Now, Google Shopping is a good example. You know, we're now integrating Google Shopping into our platform, so someone could log into Citrus, create a shopping ad for Google. So let's say I'm Smirnoff Vodka. I can, you know, target the word vodka on Google and then route it to a specific retailer. So now I can start controlling my own destiny as well as a brand. So it's quite an exciting time.
And I think that, you know, the fact that you mentioned, you know, the third-party cookie deprecation really makes this even more of an attractive proposition, because I would think you're basing most of your data off of its first party data, right? Is there any third party data? I think you mentioned that just a little bit ago, that is there targeting through third party data platforms, or is it primarily a first party audience?
it's all first party audience. It's all so first it's party. Whatever the retailer sends to us. So it's, you know, we don't cross track customers across them. Even if we could make the inference that this customer looks the same as another customer on another site, legally we don't track anybody. It's all one-to-one. Even though we have kind of virtual instances of our infrastructure, they're all very separated, so we don't track anyone. That's not to say retailers can't give us information that they have. So if they use a DMP or they use information from another third party, like an Epsilon, for example, they can use that data, send it to us, and make our data richer. So they can certainly use other they can use other parties and other systems to build out their own data warehouses, but ultimately we don't touch any other companies. We only go to the retailer for our data. And that way, that one, we can rely on it as a single source of truth, knowing that the retailer's probably scrubbed it and make sure it's good. And then we only really care about the customer that's on the page, because we're serving ads to that customer whilst they're on the, you know, t-shirts page or the laptops page or the milk page, for example.
Yeah. So talking about the ads and the personalization of those ads, as a marketer, what kind of ad formats would they be looking at? Are they putting videos together? Are they doing, you know, typical display type ads? What are the different creatives that a marketer can use on the platform?
Yeah, so right now we offer sponsored products, which tend to be the most popular because it's all performance driven. But, you know, recently we've been pushing a lot of people towards trying to push display media with sponsored products at the same time. Agencies can typically tend to run one or the other, and we're trying to get them to run them at the same time because the results are significant. So when you run them independently, the results tend to fizzle a little bit. You know, you achieve your objectives in terms of CPMs and, you know, every other objective that you try and look at when you do a display ad. But we looked over the last 3 months and, you know, if we took two sort of case studies, for example, when a brand ran sponsored products along with display campaigns at the same time, we saw two very separate, very different types of brands increase sales by 3 to 4x, and the sponsored products click-through rate increased by almost 2% whilst they were running those banner ads. Wow. So what that tells you is that the banner ads complement the sponsored products. So I see the banner, I get marketed from the banner. You know, the banner is telling me the brand message that the sponsored product cannot. You know, it tells me why I should buy it, you know, why it's good, you know, it encourages me. It's like a, you know, TV ad, video ad, whatever you want to call them. Any different type of display ad is all about trying to get your brand message across. And so when we see the brand message and then we see the product, statistically, you know, it jumps in the click-through rate, you know. So it's not rocket science, but sometimes you need to put the stats together in order for the brands to go, okay, I should be doing these at the same time. And I really should be pushing my banners and sponsored products at the same time. And the clever brands do. You know, again, Mondelez is a great example of someone who, when they go into a retailer, they go in there with a strategy of owning the page. So they'll go in and bid as much as they can to possibly own the banners and as much as they possibly can to own the sponsored products because they know that the impact of both. We deal in very different regions with very different types of retailers. So we've had to provide lots of different ad types. We provide kind of your static display ads, which are, you know, your Google sizing, you know, your 728 by 90 leaderboards, your film strips. But then we decided to go one step further and create something that was very specific to retail. So we created these banner tiles. So if you imagine a banner sitting inside a sponsored product tile. So, you know, it looks and feels like it belongs on the site. It's responsive. And they carry a click-through rate of up to 10 times what a normal banner would be. So so we found that something quite unique there. We decided that nativeness was key for retailers. Banners, you know, can sometimes look out of place. You know, they look like their banners. You know, they look like their marketing. It's like we've been conditioned to ignore them, whereas the native banners that look like tiles, so a tile or a double tile, for example, they're right there in the product grid, influencing you, able to be click on and then purchase, and they don't feel like an app. They feel like they belong to the retailer. And so when it feels like it's retailer produced, the consumer interacts with it far greater than if it feels like it's been put there by, say, like Google Ad Manager or, you know, a third party DSP or whatever it may be. So I think we've realized, you know, we've kind of cracked the nut on the sizing and how these banners should be there. And then we, you know, obviously that banner then needs to link to a brand page, which then tells an overall brand story. So we've, you know, started to pick up the where the advertiser wants to go in terms of a journey. But again, we're taking them on the journey, educating them now. You know, still it's for a lot of them, it's drinking from the fire hose. So we try and break it down as much as we can. But, you know, as a general rule of thumb, you simply cannot spend enough on retail media in terms of the what you can buy.
I mean, that resonates with me as a marketer because, you know, the traditional banner ads, no one clicks on them. We know that no one clicks on them because they look like ads. Okay, maybe the brand recall is something that we can rely on, that they're going to remember the brand and maybe Google it later on. But when we're looking at display advertising, native advertising typically has a much higher click-through rate. So that's kind of aligns with what you just said. And I like the thing that you mentioned about the 1-2 punch of doing the branding strategy as well as the more lower funnel direct response and combining those two strategies. So that's almost kind of what we think of as a marketer generally when we're doing our full funnel marketing. But we're now looking at it in the ecosystem of retail media and, you know, covering all of our bases. So that's really interesting. Question that I had, I mean, definitely with this type of retail media, we're going to see a lift in online sales. Can this also help in-store sales as well?
Yeah, definitely. We rely on retailers to give us these studies, obviously, because the data is quite precious to them. But Woolworths are an active member in sort of giving out their public information here in Australia. So they're one of the very, very large tier one grocery retailers. So, you know, they know that a click on a website, 60% of clicks turn into in-store sales within 4 days. So we know the impact that online advertising has on in-store sales as well. So I think that's, you know, it should be relatively obvious to understand. You know, people are not always shopping online, but they're using online as a channel to either browse before they go on shopping in-store, or they're looking for recommendations, or they're building a list. But typically if an in-store sale happens, usually it has been influenced by the website in some way, shape or form, particularly in grocery. So,
And are you able to match that back to, for example, in-store sales that happened, is that tying back through the database and, you know, matching it to, okay, well, this person was actually on the website the other day, clicked on one of the online ads and now ended up purchasing in this store. How are you tying that data back?
Yeah. So how you tie the data back is obviously using the loyalty ID. So we have to make sure we have both at the same time. So the logged in loyalty ID, browsing around, adding things to their list instead of the cart, and then they go in store and purchase using their loyalty ID, that attribution is able to be made. If there's no direct attribution, there's still attribution there. Like, there's still high value in being able to say that you got X amount of clicks on the site that didn't turn into direct sales, but then you had a 6% lift in those products in store. Sure. You know, it's less of a direct correlation story, but more of a, you know, it's still a good story.
It's a directional data. Yeah, that makes sense. And I think with people now getting back to going out and shopping in store now that things are getting better with the pandemic, I think we're going to probably see even better results there with in-store lifts in sales. So that's pretty exciting.
Yeah, well, I think consumers have been conditioned to at least start their shopping journey online, whether it's looking at specials, circulars, websites, adding lists. I think that's not going away anytime soon. I think, obviously, as we've seen, e-commerce grew significantly through the pandemic. It will drop off, but I don't think it'll drop off back to pre-pandemic. I think it'll definitely be at least 10% post-pandemic. But in terms of influence, I think that it's, I would say 75-80% of online activity influences in-store purchasing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think, and I do agree with you. I think the online behaviors are going to stick around. I don't think anything's going back to the way it was pre-pandemic, but it's a big shift in the way people do business and transact online. And I think that's just really interesting to see that. Well, we are getting towards the end of our time. One question that I didn't ask you, and I'm so intrigued about, I got to ask you this before we start winding down, which is, where did the name Citrus Ad come from? Is there any story behind that?
There is. It's not an overly interesting one, but I'll give it to you. Okay. So Citrus, my favorite color is green. Mm-hmm. So when I started the company, when I started my first company, I was browbeaten by a brand agency who said, you shouldn't be green because it's a weak color and you need to be blue because you're in, financial ad tech, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And I really resisted it. And from that day onwards, I'm like, my next business is going to be green. And so when we first started the company, we're like, well, we started with, we want something that's fresh, sharp, the kind of citrus came to mind, and then the tagline, refreshingly sharp advertising, we used mm-hmm. to use a lot. So we played into the line being a bit tangy and a bit
zesty.
Zesty. And we love the, the kind of, we've now moved towards like the leopard, and the kind of the hunter and, kind of being in the jungle with the lions that are bigger than us, but we're the kind of smarter, faster animal. But it all started with just wanting to be short, sharp, refreshing. I wanted to be green. And then the domain, we registered citrusad.com. Citrus.com was obviously taken at the time. But then, people just started to referring us as Citrus Ads, Citrus Ads. So, because we're an ad company, right? So sure. They're like, oh, these are the Citrus Ads guys, So then we basically just said, well, we're just going to own it. We're going to call it Citrus Ad because that's what people call us.
Yeah. So listen to the customer, so right?
Yeah. And then we rebranded because we got sick of telling people, no, it's just Citrus. That's the long, boring story.
Oh, that's very cool. Very cool. I'm thirsty now. I need a nice cold drink of something citrusy.
Champagne with a bit of lime in it, or Corona with
lime in it. Oh, yeah. That sounds very good right now. And just, I know it's early for you there, first thing in the morning, but it's coming up to that time here for me. So it's about 8 o'clock. So, yeah.
So, we're all due a drink on a Monday, aren't we?
That's right. That's very, very true. Well, I wanted to thank you so much for your time today, Brad. If the listeners would like to connect with you or contact you, where can they find you online?
Just about anywhere if you search for me. Obviously our website, citrusad.com, or email me direct at brad@citrusad.com. Find me on LinkedIn, hit me up anywhere. Awesome. Always happy to share a copy with someone, if nothing else, just to give them 30 minutes of my time, just to explain the industry. As I said, always happy to talk to anyone, founders in the space, ad tech people, brands, retailers. I try and find time for as many people as I can.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much, Brad.
No worries, Vera.
Well, that's it for today, folks. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed the show. If you did like what you heard, please subscribe to catch more episodes, and I'd really appreciate it if you'd leave a review and share with your friends and colleagues. Visit my website at verashafiq.com, connect with me on LinkedIn, Instagram, and Clubhouse, or send me an email. I'd love to hear from you. Until next time.